Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. Today, we are honored to have with us Gilbert King, the critically acclaimed and Pulitzer Prize-winning author, to discuss with us his wonderful new book titled Beneath a Ruthless Sun, A True Story of Violence, Race, and Justice Lost and Found. Welcome, Mr. King. Mr. King, I see you on the queue. Are you there? Oh, we seem to have transmission difficulties. Well, in any event, I was in New York a couple of weeks ago, and I was in the Barnes & Noble store on Fifth Avenue, and I was looking at the table with new releases, and Mr. King's book virtually leapt off the table. And the reason why it leapt off was relatively superficial. Its cover is yellow and orange and red, and it's meant to have huge, huge visual appeal. But once I got past the cover and I read the jacket, I decided this was truly, truly a book I wanted to read because it not only discussed false confessions and wrongful imprisonments and the plight of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in the criminal justice system, but it seemed to be a wonderful historical work by an award-winning author. I read it and promptly invited Mr. King to invite him to join us here on Author Chats. Let's see if we can find him again in the queue. Mr. King? Mr. King? Oh, dear. Well, maybe he will call back. In any event, I'll tap dance a little bit, and I'll try and give you a summary of this very, very rich story. Back in the late 1950s in Lake County, Florida, there was a rape of the wife of a very prominent citrus grower. And she promptly said that an African American was the perpetrator. And with that in mind, local law enforcement quickly went out and they rounded up a group of young African American men and they held them in custody. Seems like Mr. King is back on the queue. Mr. King?
Hi, Elizabeth. Can you hear me?
I can hear you
Hello? Loudly
and clearly. Yes. Can you hear me?
Oh, excellent. I can hear you perfectly.
Beautiful. All right. Well, let me put you up to speed. I've been telling the audience that I was in New York and your wonderful yellow and orange cover leapt off the new release section at the Barnes & Noble on Fifth Avenue. I decided it was a book I truly wanted to read, and I started to give the audience a brief summary of the account, and I mentioned that Mrs. Knowles had been raped. Law enforcement rounded up a group of young African American males, and you pick it up from there.
Well, you know, that's where the story really gets strange, because this has happened throughout the South over history. These accusations that start, and it starts law enforcement on this crusade to find the right African-American, and a lot of times the African-Americans in the South were falsely accused of these crimes. It was used as sort of a housekeeping thing where they decided to get, you know, quote, troublesome Negroes out of the way.
If I can interrupt you, then this story took a really weird twist because they had these young men in custody, and then all of a sudden they released them, and they targeted a young white man with an intellectual disability. How did that all happen?
Well, that was like the heart of the story. And why did this happen?
Yeah.
You know, and usually this sheriff, Willis McCall, had done this many times before. And even he was perplexed by that. But all of a sudden there was this silence. And they didn't arrest an African-American. And then they let all the African-Americans go. And then they brought in this white Jesse Daniels, a 19-year-old mentally disabled kid. And people in the community are like, why? She said that she was raped by an African-American with bushy hair. Why are they now arresting a white person? And that really forms the basis of this entire mystery. And basically what it comes down to is the reporter in the story, Mabel Norris Reese, begins to figure out why this was done. And her theory was that because Mrs. Knowles was this wealthy wife of a citrus baron and a very powerful white man in the community, it would have been seen as very impolite and sort of improper for her to have been officially raped by an African American. And so some very powerful people got together and changed the race of the suspect and said, oh no, it was a white person, and they needed to find a very powerless defendant. And Jesse Daniels fit that bill perfectly.
And then, as I was telling the audience during the setup, this is not your typical story of a wrongful imprisonment. The Jesse was not convicted by a jury of attacking Mrs. Knowles, but rather he was sent to Chattahoochee. Tell everyone about what Chattahoochee was and what it was like back in the late 1950s, and what happened to Jesse there.
Well, that's one of the most horrible parts of the story, is that, you know, they thought they were doing him a favor maybe, because, you know, the reason is Blanche Knowles did not want to testify against Jesse Daniels. And so when they had that problem, they realized that a trial could be a little bit testy. And so they said, well, we don't need to have a trial. We'll just declare him insane and send him to a mental institute, and he'll never get out. It'll be the same thing as prison. But actually, it was much worse than prison, because Jesse went into this Florida State Hospital, this asylum, where it was just one of the most violent places in all of the South. So he was, you know, abused physically and mentally, and you know, he spent 14 years without a hearing, without a trial, at this place. And it wasn't that he was wrongly convicted. That would be the strange part. That would be one strange part of the story. What ended up happening to Jesse Daniels is there was a conspiracy to frame him and not give him a trial. And his own defense attorney was in on that conspiracy. And so they all got together and railroaded Jesse Daniels to this awful place up in the Florida Panhandle, where he'd spend the next 14 years of his life.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly, and we're talking with Gilbert King about his newly released book titled Beneath a Ruthless Sun, A True Story of Violence Raced and Justice Lost and Found. Mr. King, tell our listeners a little bit about Lake County, Florida, back in the 1950s, because the image that so many of us have of the Sunshine State is of tall skyscrapers in Miami and lovely beaches. What was Lake County like?
Well, Lake County was sort of north central Florida, and there's an expression in Florida to sort of give you an idea of what the state is like geographically and demographically, where Floridians will say the further north you go, the further south you get. And so when you come up from Miami and get closer up to Georgia, you start to see the deep south. And that's what Lake County was like. It was, you know, you could see cattle and oranges for as far as the eye could see. It was not the skyscrapers and the diversity of Miami. And so this was really the old South. It doesn't seem like it. It's not like a traditional cotton belt South like Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia. A lot of people didn't really know what to think of Florida because they had a progressive governor, but there were pockets of Florida that were just as bad as the worst parts of Mississippi and Alabama. And that's exactly what you had in Lake County, with a very powerful sheriff who made no bones about being a white supremacist. He was the leader of the Klan, and he had a 28-year reign in Lake County. And, you know, I think one of the reasons I was able to write this book is that he had come onto the radar of the FBI and the Department of Justice so many times that there was just this wealth of civil rights investigations and interviews and reports about him and about his reign. And so it was just this overwhelming wealth of material I had to work from.
Well, that raises the issue. How did you first of all learn about the case of Jesse?
Well, it's really interesting because I'd written about Lake County before in my book Devil in the Grove, and I was really not looking, any way of going back to Lake County and doing another story there. And so I was at a talk down there in Florida, and this old gentleman came up to me, and he basically said that he was a deputy back in the 1950s for Willis McCall. And he said, you got your story right on Devil in the Grove, but, there's another story that you didn't get on at all. And he went on to tell me how the department had framed an innocent man of rape and that they sent him away for 14 years. And, he felt a great amount of, regret and the case haunted him that he never spoke up about it. And, he told me, he said, look, this is a different case.
Wow.
This involves very powerful people. And no one's going to talk to you. And I found that in the beginning. But after a while, people started to talk to me. And I just knew that this was a story, no matter where it took place in the country, I wanted to write it.
Yeah. So you mentioned that Jesse was basically incarcerated at Chattahoochee for approximately 14 years. Tell us what his family and his supporters were doing all of that time.
Well, one of the tragic parts of it is that, Jesse's father was this disabled World War I veteran. He was elderly. He couldn't work. And so they really were relying on his Army pension, which was not very much. And also his mother, Pearl Daniels, who picked watermelons. She worked in the watermelon field. So she's uneducated, and she really has no resources to fight. All she knows is that she's been taking care of her only child, Jesse Daniels, for 19 years. And, authorities described him as a 19-year-old boy with a 7-year-old mind because of his mental disability. And so, he was still sleeping with a teddy bear and a baby penguin. And, he was basically a kid. And, when he's sent off into Chattahoochee, he's probably the most vulnerable person in that institute because of his disability. And, Pearl Daniels was just a mother who just refused to give up the fight. She started investigating the case on her own. She started getting more and more facts. She started working with the reporter, Mabel Norris Reese. And together they sort of formed this really strange friendship of two people who would not back down from this injustice. And they were determined to right it. And so Jesse really had a couple people in his life that truly loved him and cared about him. And if it wasn't for them, I think he would have spent the rest of his life at Chattahoochee.
And the powers that be in Lake County did not make life easy for Mabel, did they?
No, they really didn't. And that was one of the things, if you look at Mabel's arc, her character arc, in Devil in the Grove, she starts out as sort of on the sheriff's side, and she's reporting the things he says, and she's describing Lake County as this idyllic place of racial content. But then after the sheriff had shot the two defendants, the Groveland boys, on the side of the road, she starts to have an awakening, and she's determined that she's never going to take McCall's word for things anymore, and she was going to report on all his abuses of authority and civil rights. And so she starts reporting on it, and she starts, calling for, the Brown versus Board decision. She calls for restraint and gradual, accepting of the Supreme Court's decision. And that kind of reporting earned her like a cross burned in her yard from the Klan. They poisoned her dog. They bombed her house. And ultimately, after destroying her offices, they basically set up a rival newspaper, and Sheriff Willis McCall went around warning all of Mabel's advertisers to no longer advertise with her. And so they ruined her and basically ran her out of town. Still, she went to Daytona about 60 miles away, and she still kept reporting on Sheriff Willis McCall from out of town. Mm. And ultimately, it was her reporting that really made a big difference in this case.
Most of the players in this case are long gone. But nonetheless, what has been the response in Lake County and the surrounding area to your book?
Well, that was one of the things I was kind of worried about, again, because people said that no one's going to talk to you, no one will mention this case, it involves powerful people, it's a very indelicate subject, and I did find that early on in the going, but I think as I started reporting and spent so many years down there working on this story, more and more people started to open up, including the family of the victim in this case, Blanche Knowles. And so I was very grateful for that because it helped me really understand all the personalities. And I think the book is much richer because of that. I would say almost uniformly, the response I'm getting is very positive and sort of, we need to acknowledge this. This is a part of our past. There were a lot of people who heard rumors about this case because, again, it really wasn't covered in the media except for Mabel, and Mabel was ultimately forced out of town. And so a lot of people in Lake County were not really aware of the details of this story. They were just aware of rumors, and the rumors could go all over the place. And so I think when they see how, you know, I was very diligent about making sure that I stuck to the facts and that I used everything I could be sourced, I think ultimately there was a great acceptance. Like, this was a shameful story in Lake County's past, and people accepted it and they supported it.
Yeah. Well, this was a rich and a wonderful read, and appreciate all of your investigation, and certainly commend Beneath a Ruthless Sun to all of our listeners. Thanks so much, Mr. King, for joining us here on Author Chats.
Thank you, Elizabeth. It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you to all of my listeners. You've been listening to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. We've been talking with Gilbert King, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, about his latest book, Beneath a Ruthless Sun, a true story of violence, race, and justice lost and found. Please remember, injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere. Have a good day.